This is the Recent Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. I am excited as hell about today's guest. It's John Tierney, who is the co-author of a new book called The Power of Bad, How the Negativity Effect Rules Us and How We Can Rule It. But before we get to my conversation with him, I want to ask you to subscribe to this podcast and to Reason's other podcasts by going to reason.com/podcasts and signing up for The Reason Interview, The Reason Roundtable, and the Soho Forum Debates. It's all much appreciated. Now let's talk about The Power of Bad, which Tierney has written with the psychologist Roy F. Baumeister. A couple of years ago, they teamed up on a best-selling book called Willpower, which will help you figure out how to get all that stuff done that you say you really want to get done but never get around to. Now, their main message is this. It's really not just in your head. When it comes to how we all experience life, bad is generally stronger than good. They say we remember trauma more than joy. We're brought down by criticism more than we're elevated by praise, and we pay more attention to bad news than good. The Power of Bad explores the negativity effect, or the universal tendency for negative events and emotions to affect us more strongly than positive ones. The negativity effect, say Tierney and Baumeister, shapes everything in our lives, from our personal relationships to our careers to how we vote to what media we consume. But The Power of Bad isn't just one more cause for despair. Its subtitle is How the Negativity Effect Rules Us and How We Can Rule It. And it offers practical tips on all sorts of ways to approach life so that we can be happy, productive, and well-adjusted. I sat down to talk with John Tierney. He's a contributing editor at the Manhattan Institute's City Journal, and he's a former New York Times columnist and reporter who has also contributed to Reason over the years. We talked about the root causes of the negativity effect and how to combat it. Here is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie with John Tierney. John Tierney, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks.
So explain the negativity effect. What is it?
It's the universal tendency for bad events, bad emotions to affect us more strongly than good ones. It's also called negativity bias. And Roy Baumeister identified this in a famous paper called Bad is Stronger Than Good, which is another way to say
it. That's a credo that comes up throughout the book.
Right. And, you know, and our credo is bad is stronger than good, but good can prevail if you buy our book. So it's basically this tendency that bad parenting makes a big difference, good parenting doesn't. Criticism hurts so much more than praise. There's much more brain activity when you see something negative than when you see something positive.
Can you give some concrete examples of this, where bad clearly overpowers good?
Well, a bad first impression is really tough to shake, whereas a good first impression can be overcome, very
You can
quickly.
Always screw it up later.
Right, exactly. And, yeah. and penalties work a lot better than rewards as far as motivating people. And we have a chapter in the book about how, looking at the history of religions that preach hell grow much faster than ones that basically promise you eternal rewards. People, that's what fills the pews. The brain just evolved to respond to bad things.
You talk about, at various points, a 4-to-1 ratio, a 5-to-1 ratio of where, it's like four bad things. One bad thing. You need four or five good things to overcome it. What are some cases where that's the case?
Well, they found it, for instance, studying people's diaries. And when they count up workers' diaries and they count up the good things that happened and the bad things and then people's overall mood after that. And they find that it takes about four good things to make up for one setback at work. One bad moment at work takes four good things to overcome that. Basically, people who are happy tend to have three or four times more good emotions than bad emotions, more good days than bad days. Roy kind of stumbled into this early on where he was in this relationship and he wasn't sure whether to stay or not because they were, he was happy most of the time, but there were some really bad days. And he just started counting, is today a good day or a bad day? And he found that it was 2-to-1. And he just felt this isn't really enough.
Yeah. And you guys even talk about how in the sex is not, sex can help, but good sex isn't going to save a relationship.
Right. I mean, bad sex matters a lot more than good sex. But the, I mean, that's another example of the 4-to-1 rule that, in fact, psychologists talk about the, or therapists talk about the 4 fucks for every fight rule, basically, that, you know, that.
Not my therapist, but I'm glad to hear it exists.
But it's not, I mean, some people have very little sex, but they don't fight. And so they get along. Some people have more sex, but they, so it's really the ratio that matters. It's called the positivity ratio that psychologists study. And that's really what determines how happy you are, how well something's going. It's a good way to measure progress.
And some of, a lot of the book, we're going to get into the larger kind of social and political implications of a lot of the work here. But, I mean, a lot of it is almost, I don't want to say self-help, but it's news you can use both in your relationships and at the job.
Right. We're trying to tell people that in relationships, first do no harm, that it's the bad stuff that really matters and that avoiding bad is so much more important than doing good. Like, you don't get extra credit for going the extra mile, for doing more than you promise, but you pay a really big price when you don't.
So, but then it seems in a way you confound yourselves or contradict yourselves, because you talk about a high school football coach who is famous for always trying on the fourth down,
right.
And you guys look at the numbers and it turns out statistically it actually makes sense for football teams to go for it on fourth down,
right?
Almost always, but almost nobody does. Why don't more coaches go on fourth and a yard?
Well, that's one consequence of the negativity effect. We call it safety addiction. The people get so obsessed with, what's the worst outcome that could happen? What's the bad outcome? They fixate on that, and therefore they're very irrational in their safety addiction that I just don't want to risk that. I mean, Lenore Skenazy at Reason has written about how parents are obsessed about letting their kids walk to school because they're so obsessed with the chance that a stranger will abduct them.
So if you have one kid who is brutally kidnapped and disappears forever, you need to have at least 4 more kids to make up for it, right?
Not exactly. That's not in the book.
Explain the Garcia effect and how that fits into, the themes of your book.
Back during the glory days of behaviorism, when everyone was studying how rats responded to rewards and punishments, there was this idea that you had to have instantaneous reward or punishment for a rat for it to happen. And they were doing these experiments with rats, and they noticed that they were subjecting them to radiation, and they noticed that some rats, when they drank from this sweet liquid and then later got radiation and got really sick, they would never drink from that same plastic thing with liquid again. And yet the pain, from drinking from that, and it had nothing to do with it, but they associated it with it. But the weird thing was, is that it was supposed to happen within like 2 seconds. You had to do a reward or punishment. And this happened months later, and people thought Garcia was making this up. There was something wrong. But they found that something bad, that radiation stuff was so bad that people actually could learn, that the learning could actually take place months later, which you can never do that with good. I mean, a reward would never work that way unless you gave it immediately after it. But the penalty, the pain was so much stronger that it actually worked later.
And as a result, this comes into play when people, if they drink too much, they blame whatever liquor they happen to be blaming and saying.
Right, when you get sick once on one kind of liquor, then people don't. I mean, I don't drink gin because of one, time in college when that happened. And I think that's like one bad thing can make so much difference that you just won't touch it again.
Let's talk about where the negativity effect or the negativity bias comes from. You mentioned, part of this is evolution. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? And if it's evolution, can we really change anything?
Well, it's definitely adaptive because, the people who survived on the ancestral savanna were people who paid more attention to,
they were the ones who fucked more than they fought.
They did that too, okay. Yes. And they also, but they were very alert to threats because, one mistake can kill you. And in that sense, it's still useful because one mistake can still really hurt you at work or can still hurt you. It can be fatal. But the problem, the analogy we draw is that it was useful on the ancient savanna to fatten up on calories during lean times, but it's not so useful today when you're surrounded by junk food all the time. And today we're just surrounded by bad all the time.
Well, one of the bad things that you particularly point out has to do with social media. Mm-hmm. You guys are critical of social media, although not in the way that a lot of people are. But talk about how does social media kind of amplify or screw with the negativity effect?
Well, I mean, it's amplified in the sense that you get this instantaneous reaction and that people can use it as a platform to go negative, and it's an easy way to get instant attention. But the interesting thing about social media versus mass media is that mass media appeals to our common interest. You've got to go to mass, and the things that we all share, those interests, tend to be negative. We're all afraid of dying, we're all afraid of crime, we're all afraid. So it's very, that's what mass media goes for. But the things that, the good things that interest us, you know, our cultural passions, and we're interested in the science or in a certain kind of art, those things are much more individualistic. And that's what social media is better at. You know, that, and so people tend to be more positive on social media than mass media. People tend to share positive stories much more than negative stories. The mass media is filled with bad news. But social media, most people, now the people who really dominate Twitter, these sort of pundits who are slugging it out, they're trolls, they're negative. But on social media, people who post more positive stuff on Twitter, they actually get more followers and retweeted more often than negative stuff, because people don't share pictures of school shootings. They tend to share stuff that they're passionate about, you know, books that they like, and people on social media are looking on, you know, on YouTube, they're looking at how-to videos, at comic videos, the stuff that they really like, as opposed to negative, you know, scare stories.
And even in mass media, you point out, you point to studies of kind of counts of negative terms versus positive terms in places like the New York Times. And the news is actually more positive than it is negative, right?
Right. There is this thing called the Pollyanna principle that a researcher started counting the number of positive and negative words that people use, and they've sort of expanded this to massive database things looking at all media. And the surprising thing is that people use positive words more often than negative words in every kind of medium. And even when you look at tragic novels, there's still, the endings are pretty bad, but most of it is fairly positive. And I think this evolved, it's our natural defense against negativity, that we basically try to and that's the secret to overcoming the negativity effect, is overwhelming it with positivity. And we do have this natural tendency because we're social animals. I mean, people don't like being around people who are downers. So you basically, you know, there's a social reward for being upbeat, for using positive words. And I think we naturally tend to do that. You know, even on days when there's a terrorist attack or something, you know, Twitter immediately goes negative, but then it tends to rebound because people start posting stories about someone who saved someone's life during this. You know, we have this natural tendency to want to deal with that somehow.
Another factor on why negativity wins, or, you know, the power of that overwhelms, is capitalism itself, really. You quote a line in the book saying, no food, one problem, much food, many problems. Mm-hmm. How does, you know, you are a fan of capitalism, you're a defender, a proponent of it. Mm-hmm. How is capitalism implicated in the power of that?
I mean, one way is simply that it's an easier way to get people's attention. When you're selling something, it's basically scare. You know, you have bad breath, you have this problem, and I'm going to scare you about it and get you to buy a product. But the larger way is that, as you say, that as you solve basic problems like where's the next meal come from, our brain has this natural tendency to start looking for problems, and so we start finding new problems. You know, there was a great experiment Dan Gilbert did where he was asking people to identify all the blue dots you saw, and they would reduce the prevalence of the blue dots as time went on, and people would keep seeing the same number of them. They start identifying purple dots as blue. He calls it prevalence-induced concept change, and basically that the richer you get, you know, the more first-world problems you find. Hmm.
So let's talk about some of the ways to combat the negativity effect, because your subtitle is How the Negativity Effect Rules Us and How We Can Rule It. Some of the ways to combat the negativity effect, you talk about prizes over penalties. What do you mean by that?
Penalties work better than prizes, but we tend, you know, there's been this whole everybody gets a trophy movement, and it comes out of the self-esteem movement, and, you know, which is one of the sorrier mistakes in psychology. And parents and teachers.
I just want to point out, I would have no trophies if not for participation trophies, so screw you. But continue.
And you would be so much better off today if you hadn't gotten those false rewards.
That's what's holding me back.
Exactly.
Yeah. You also talk about combating the negativity effect by delivering good news last. but not always. But what is it about, you know, when you're giving people good news and bad news, why does it make sense to deliver good news second?
And well, the classic example of this is the criticism sandwich, which managers used to give, which is that you start out with, you know, some good stuff, that, you know, then you sandwich in a little criticism and you end with a little good stuff. But the problem is that once you hear criticism affects you so strongly, that when you hear that, it basically, you forget what you heard before that. So, you know, so someone who gets this and they can say, you did all these things right, oh, but here's a problem, that's all they remember. So basically, and most people would also rather hear the bad news first. Most of us would rather give good news first because it's easier to start that way. But people want to get the bad stuff out of the way. And then after they get the bad stuff, their brain's on high alert. And then the good stuff can sink in once the brain is on alert that way.
You talk about, there's a great chapter in the book about a place called the Casablanca Hotel, which is here in New York City, and it's the Casablanca Hotel versus the Moon Lady. How is this an object lesson in how to overcome the power of bad?
The Casablanca has been in the top 10, usually the number one hotel in New York in TripAdvisor for more than a decade, and they are just fanatics about overcoming the negativity effect, because what kills you is a few bad reviews, you know, and so they are just fanatics. From the moment you call that hotel to make a reservation, when you arrive, the guy who greets you at the door, at the front desk, they want to eliminate any bad thing at all that could happen, and they have every single step of the way, and they mingle with the guests every day at receptions. It's all about trying to avoid any bad thing at all and avoid those negative reviews.
And the Moon Lady left a particularly bad review.
This crazy woman, you know, showed up at midnight and wanted a room with a view of the moon. And they said, well, you know, and this is in the middle of Manhattan, surrounded by skyscrapers. And they gave her a room, and then she posted a review claiming there were no windows at all in the room, which was just ridiculous. But that kind of review can kill a hotel, because it's just, you know, a one-star review makes so much more difference than a five-star review. And so, but they basically have managed, and her review stayed up, but they have just swamped it with so many positive reviews. And that's sort of the key to online success, is avoiding the negative.
You mentioned in passing the Pollyanna principle. What is that, and how does that work in this context?
I mean, that's the brain's natural tendency to fight back by overwhelming bad with good stuff. And it specifically refers to this idea that we use language more often, good words more often than bad words. And we expand it to this whole idea of Pollyanna, which is this dreadful novel and movie about this, you know, girl who plays the glad game. And she's glad about everything that happens. And it's really, I mean, it's awful. You know, people have always hated this book because it seems so false.
You tell the story of the first people to make a silent movie of it. We're like gagging.
Right.
As
Mary
they were
Pickford
filming it.
Was nauseated, the star. But it made her career. And it's always been this huge hit.
And that's like, you know, being looking at the upside.
Right. It's whatever happens, you're glad that it happens. And as bad as it sounds, I mean, the reason that movie succeeded so much is that it does express this fundamental truth. And psychologists have found a bunch of glad games for people to play.
Yeah, and then that's the glad game is another way of talking about this. Yeah. That includes things like changing the narrative, sharing good news, rejoicing in other people's good news, listing blessings and gratitude, having nostalgia, but not getting stuck in the past. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, we're often told if you have nostalgia, you're screwed because you're always looking backwards and you're stuck in the past. Why is a certain amount of nostalgia a good thing?
Well, that was the old view, that it was considered this pathology, and there were all these bizarre explanations. It was a sign of depression. And then in the last, like, you know, 10 or 20 years, they've been doing experiments, and they found that actually nostalgia really, that it lifts your spirits and that it makes you more optimistic. Mm-hmm. It actually makes you feel warmer when you're in a cold room. And people who engage in nostalgia more often tend to be happier. That's one reason that older people tend to be happier than younger people, is that they engage in more nostalgia. And you're basically just enjoying those, you know, those memories from the past. Now, the bad kind of nostalgia is when you're thinking, oh, those are the days, we'll never get them back. And, you know, a better way is to just think, that was a great time, I'm enjoying that. And sharing it with someone else is great, too. You both remember those moments. And
you talk critically about the crisis industry, what you call the crisis industry. And you compare a woman named Patty Wetterling to the creators of Megan's Law. Can you explain who Patty Wetterling is and why she's you know, she's somebody we should model ourselves on.
Right. Her son was killed, one of these awful stories of a child being abducted, and there was a law passed named after her son, and she was there in the Rose Garden when they signed Megan's Law. She was one of the activists for that.
And this helped create National Sex Offender Registry.
Right, the whole registry. Yeah. And so she was, of course, all for that, and then she realized, and then she started to see, and Lenore Skenazy and Reason have written a lot about this, that these laws have just turned out to be awful things that are ensnaring all these people and ruining people's lives. And she has now turned into a crusader against it. And one of the proposals in the book that we have is called Let's Enact Patty's Law, which would be a law forbidding any law from being named after a child or anyone else. Because it's one of the cheapest emotional tricks is to name a law after a victim. Because how do you vote against a victim?
Hmm. So. You also talk about maintaining a low bad diet. What does that mean, and can I have ice cream?
A low bad diet is basically curating the news. I mean, it's a general concept for your life, is trying to avoid bad things you do, trying to avoid overreacting to bad things, and trying basically to get a good positivity ratio. And you can do that, especially in the media you consume, by choosing whom you follow, by choosing what you watch, you know, and trying to keep the ratio of bad stuff. I mean, when there's a terrorist shooting or a school shooting, you know, don't wallow watching live coverage.
Here is a question for you. When you blow this stuff up from kind of the personal world or your work world to the political world, it's clear that politicians mostly, they traffic in a lot of bad stuff. They say, you know, if we don't do this, crisis mm-hmm. will happen. Or we're already in a crisis. You guys mentioned the vaping epidemic now, et cetera. Why do people assume that political solutions will work if we're wired to being pessimistic or negative about most actions that people take?
I mean, the Chicken Little, story is a great parable, I think, where she overinterprets this crisis, an acorn falls on her head. She says the sky is falling. And then there's this classic reaction, something must be done. This is something, therefore it must be done. And what happens is that the fox comes along and says, you can all seek shelter in my den. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens when there's a crisis, that there's this crisis industry of journalists, activists, politicians who declare a crisis and then they offer a solution for it that benefits some special interest, like the fox, mm-hmm. or benefits politicians, and it grows the government. You know, this is, it's one of the things in my career that when I first started in the newspaper business as an intern, I found myself shamelessly hyping this weather story, you know, mm-hmm. and I was thinking, why am I doing that? I'm trying to turn this routine thing into a crisis.
What do you mean by that? Talk about the weather.
Well,
story.
It was a silly story. I was at the Philadelphia Bulletin, and as a low man on the totem pole, I was assigned to write, there was a heat wave in August, and I had to write about it. And so I was calling the police at the Jersey Shore for, like, what's going on? Everybody's fleeing to the shore. And I started asking, the desk sergeant, is this the worst traffic you've ever seen? And most of them say, it's always bad in August. But one guy says, yeah, it's the worst I've ever seen. And my story the next day is, in what police called the worst traffic in history. And even then I knew how sleazy this was. But and I just started wondering, you know, why does this happen? Why do we hype this stuff so much? Mm-hmm. And then a lot of my career in journalism has been observing that every crisis that you see in the news, you know, when you look into it, you know, it's not as bad as it seems. I mean, our rules are that the world will always seem to be in crisis. The crisis is never as bad as it sounds, and the solution could easily make things worse.
Could you talk, you know, the biggest story now, and there are like nothing but big, gigantic stories, you know, kind of rolling around now, but is probably global warming and climate change. Very quickly, you know, because the people who talk about it say, you know, we have 10 or 12 years before it's all over, baby. Why are they wrong, and why should we be skeptical of the Green New Deal or other fixes to, you know, make the weather perfect again?
Right. Well, the same people doing this are the people who previously told us that we were going to starve to death because of overpopulation, the billions were going to starve to death, and then there was the energy crisis where we're all going to run out of energy. When those things didn't pan out, I mean, what happens is there is this crisis industry, and as soon as one thing doesn't happen, they pivot to another. Now, I agree with Ron Bailey at Reason that climate change is a real problem. It's not a catastrophe at the moment, mm-hmm. but with the long-term thing, there are problems. But it's a classic case where the, you know, turning into a crisis doesn't work. There have been so many bad predictions and so many attempts to blame every little bit of weather for it that a lot of people simply don't take it seriously anymore. And, you know, so further, and the other thing is that the solutions that the crisis mongers are pushing don't, are completely unrealistic. So, you know, they're pushing, you know, solar power and wind power, and Greens, for instance, in Germany and in Europe, they're against fracking, they're against natural gas and nuclear power, which are the only two practical methods at the moment of making a large-scale difference. I mean, the U.S. is actually doing much better at reducing emissions than Europe is, because we're not listening to the green prescription. And so what happens is that they're seizing this crisis, this supposed crisis, to basically, you know, line their own pockets and to create more jobs for themselves.
Right, and literally to advance an agenda that has nothing to do with climate change.
Right,
right. So
exactly.
A guaranteed job program, right, and things like that.
Right.
You, obviously, you have decades of experience as a journalist, and you both, I guess, abetted certain kinds of scaremongering, as well as you spent, mm-hmm, I mean, you're best known for kind of puncturing a lot of, you know, scary myths. Roy Baumeister, psychologist. A lot of the book relies on relatively new psychological research. How do we know, I mean, as a lay reader, how do you know how to sift through what's good and what's kind of junk science? Because there's, you know, psychologists are putting out papers every day. Some of them are good, some of them are bad. All of them kind of get treated equally in the press.
Right. It's very tough. I mean, one thing is that bad news, of course, always gets more attention. And in writing about this, about social media, for instance, I started looking into it, and my inclination was, social media is bad for us. We're seeing all these things of Facebook depression and Instagram envy. And then I started looking more, and I found people who'd done meta-analyses, and they said, you know, really, this stuff doesn't really hold up. You know, that, you know, teenagers, some people are affected by social media, but really still the main thing that teenagers are affected by is people in their, you know, real life. And so teenagers have always had this. So I think, you know, it's hard to sift out this stuff. I think you have to try and rely on not just one study, not on one small experiment involving college students, but you have to look at someone who's really surveyed something that's been replicated. And I mean, the negativity effect, I mean, to toot my own horn, there have been hundreds of studies on that now that, you know, basically confirming it. So
it's a full-blown mass hysteria. So we must believe it.
Exactly. If enough people do.
We'll leave it there. We've been talking with John Tierney. He is the author most recently of The Power of Bad, How the Negativity Effect Rules Us and How We Can Rule It. John, thanks for talking.
Thank you.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please go to reason.com/podcast or Apple or Google or Stitcher or Spotify or SoundCloud or wherever you get your podcasts, and please subscribe to this podcast along with Reason's other podcasts, The Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum Debates. Thanks.